You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Good evening. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas & Parrish, LLC, and Communications Workers Local 6360. Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish, since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would do harm. And Communications Workers Local 6360 represents workers at AT&T, Landtel Communications, Rogers Printing, E2 Embroidery, Mood Media, and 911 dispatchers for the City of Independence and Jackson County. We work every day to protect workers' rights. Buying union-made products helps us all keep good jobs. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, last September, inmates in prisons across the nation went on strike against exploitative work, saying it's a lot like slavery. On tonight's show, we'll find out what's next. Also, we'll talk to labor historian Priscilla Marolo about how the U.S. working class fought back against the rise of fascism in the 1930s. Are there any lessons here for today? In the news, a tidal wave of anti-worker bills has been pre-filed in the Missouri legislature, and IKEA announces paid parental leave for its workers. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. Kudos to IKEA, you know, that's that furniture store with the meatballs, for announcing that its U.S. employees who are new parents will receive longer parental leave. Starting January 1st, 13,000 salaried and hourly employees who are mothers or fathers by birth, adoption or foster parents, will be offered up to 4 months of paid parental leave. IKEA had previously given women giving birth 5 days of paid leave in addition to 6 to 8 weeks of paid disability leave. The amount of paid leave depends on the number of years of seniority an employee has.
The St. Louis Labor Tribune reports that Representative Holly Ryder, Republican of Sykeston, has introduced HB 91, which would make it a Class C misdemeanor for employers and unions to negotiate a contract requiring members of a bargaining unit to pay dues for services the union must provide under federal law. That's otherwise known as right to work, a misnomer that's stuck but gives nobody a job. Senator Dan Brown of Rolla introduced the same bill in the Senate, SB 19. Then there's Representative Bill White, who has his own right to work bill. Senate President Pro Tem Ron Richard, Republican of Joplin, has said that this so-called right-to-work law is the number one issue in the Senate, meaning the proposal could sail through the legislature after lawmakers are sworn in on January 4th. House Minority Leader Gail McCann Beatty of Kansas City was sharply critical of the legislation and issued a statement calling for the measure to be placed on a statewide ballot for voters to decide. She said, since right to work would mark such a massive shift in the balance of power between employers and employees, Missouri voters, not politicians and their special interest donors, must have the final say on this matter.
The St. Louis Labor Tribune also reports that four bills limiting or repealing prevailing wage, all sponsored by Republicans, were also pre-filed in the House and Senate. One of these bills would bar the Missouri Housing Development Commission from requiring a prevailing hourly wage to be paid to a contractor on a project for a housing tax credit if it is in a governor-declared disaster area. Another would allow public bodies to opt out of prevailing wage laws for the construction of public works projects that are $750,000 or less. A third would establish the School Construction Act, which exempts construction and maintenance work done for certain school districts from the prevailing wage requirement upon the school board's approval. And a couple of others would repeal prevailing wage entirely. And then there's the so-called Paycheck Deception, or SB 21. It would require public employee unions to obtain annual written consent to withhold union dues and voluntary political donations. SB 87, if passed, requires the State Board of Mediation to conduct an election every 2 years to recertify a public employee union.
So who is to blame for all of these anti-worker bills? Both Senate Minority Leader Gina Walsh, who is also president of the Missouri State Building Trades Council, and a retired installation worker, and Mike Lewis, president of the Missouri AFL-CIO, point the finger at wealthy donors. Walsh told the Labor Tribune, "The legislation is more about the bottom line for Missouri's greedy 1% and less about moving Missouri forward. Apparently, it's time to pay back the few of the 1% who bought the Missouri legislature this year." She said the anti-worker push will send ripples through the economy as workers with less money in their pockets will spend less and utilize fewer services. "It's bad for the working class," Walsh said. "It's going to create more have-nots and less haves. There won't be a middle class. It's going to drive down wages for everybody." The anti-union push has been largely fueled and funded by David Humphreys. A Joplin roofing magnate and union hater, Humphreys and his family spent more than $11 million this year trying to oust union-friendly Republicans from the Missouri legislature and elect Eric Greitens governor. Lewis of the Missouri AFL-CIO said Humphreys is getting exactly what he paid for. "When you own that many politicians because you bought them and got them elected, you get what you pay for. Unfortunately, the people who are really going to pay are the working people of the state of Missouri with this bad legislation. It's going to hurt all of the workers in Missouri." And he urged Missouri's working people to make their voices heard. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Molly Madden, Tino Scalisi, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Barbara Wright.
And I'm Molly Madden.
We're happy to have you join us. Jumping right into today's show, we intend to shed light on the exploitation of prison labor, which some say is a lot like slavery. September 9th, I believe it was, we had one of the largest prison strikes in the history of our country, and you may not have even heard about it. Before we can shed some light on that, I want to make sure that you know a little bit about the history of prisons and why people sometimes refer to it as similar to slavery. Molly, can you give us a little bit of the history that you had on slavery?
One of the best books that I came across was a historical book about slavery was by Douglas Blackman. It was called Slavery by Another Name, where black men, including teenagers, were picked up off the street, charged with loitering, and placed in local jails. Then they were leased out to owners of mines, foundries, plantations, turpentine farms, etc. This time period was post-Reconstruction. You know how the white folks didn't like Reconstruction. Up until World War II. And then the propaganda was really bad for the United States, you know, the way they were treating black people. So it eased up during World War II and afterwards.
Well, maybe we can have a little light shed on that also by having a real news clip. It was an interview September 11th called Work Stoppage, Prison Strike Continues in 11 U.S. States by Eddie Conway with Reverend Kenneth Conway in Alabama.
And that's what we're leading up to. What we're leading up to is addressing the government in the Constitution about the 13th Amendment. That exception clause in there, it says no man can be held under involuntary servitude or in slavery except or by for felony conviction. So those are the things that we all have to address. And this is the reason for the National Day of Solidarity that just occurred September 9th. This is the reason for us having all of this national prison strike. And this is the reason they have a hunger strikes and all and continuing to this day. Because these things need to be addressed. People need to realize that they are using your sons, your daughters, your nieces, your nephews, your mothers, your fathers inside the prison system. They're using them for free prison labor. Some of the most profound companies and industries that we are sitting up there patronizing, that we're sitting up there supporting, spending our dollars with, are using our people for slavery.
Thank you very much, man. Hopefully you were able to hear that entire clip. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But first, I would like for you to kind of understand the numbers that are related to the number of prisoners that we have in this country. Right now, there's 2.2 million, I think that number is a little bit higher right now, of incarcerated people in the U.S., most of those being black and Hispanic. That's about 25% of the world's population right here in America. That's where the prisoners are, 25% of them. And America only has about 5% of the world's population. So that kind of gives you an idea of how many prisoners we have. The other thing that, as he was talking about, they're making lots of money on the prisoners here in this country. To give you an idea, in 1998, I think we had about 5 private prisons and they had about 2,000 inmates. Now we have over 45,000 immigrants and inmates daily that's up from 2015, because in 2015 we had about 31,000, and now this year we've had up to as many as 45,000 per day. Molly, can you tell me about how many states have legalized prison labor?
Private prisons.
Yes.
Right?
About how many of those?
They said about 37 states.
There are about 37 states have legalized this. So we have a lot of corporations that are making money on the prisoners. One of them that I took a look at was Corrections Corporation of America. Now, just recently, and I think that's probably because of a recent movie that was out called 13 and the strike that has come out, the strike was related to something that had happened in the past, and it was called Attica.
That was 45 years ago.
It was 45 years ago that Attica happened, and that was in the state of New York, I believe. And in that facility, there was quite a few. Go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Rockefeller sent in the National Guard, and they massacred not only the prisoners but the guards, and then tried to blame the massacre on the prisoners. the guards were only killed by, I think maybe one might have been seriously hurt and died at the hands of prisoners, but all the guards who died were from the National Guard just shooting, you know, without any regard for anybody.
I believe there was 29 of the prisoners killed and 10 guards were killed during that insurgence. And so what they did recently was to kind of bring back the remembrance of that and also shed light on some of the things that are happening even today in the prisons. Back then, they were complaining about food being withheld. They were saying that sometimes if they got put in solitary confinement, they didn't get fed at all. And there was an amendment that we had back in the day in the 1800s. Do you remember the amendment?
I thought it was 13.
The 13th Amendment?
And slavery was abolished except in prisons.
Or
prison population, they can come out on a chain gang, like
but
a music set.
Even the prisoners and may have, should receive humane treatment. And many of these people were saying that they were receiving inhumane treatment. And I think they had about a list of 11 or 12 demands that they wanted. One of them was freedom of religion. Now, in Attica's defense, I did read that they did get to have some freedoms as far as religion are concerned. Some of the Muslims could wear their kufi. They didn't have to cut their hair. The Indians didn't have to cut their hair. But many things that they complained about back during Attica, they are still complaining about today, saying maybe that they don't get adequate food. I think now they complained about not getting fruit back then, and I read recently that they do get 2 to 3 pieces of fruit a week. And
as we
know, the big bill for prison has to do with the health. So if we're not feeding them properly, which, you know, is not a...
Hepatitis C is rampant. There's other diseases that are rampant in the prison, and they just don't pay attention. And they don't receive adequate medical care for these conditions. When you're almost dead, they give you a little care.
Well, the Marshall Project article, this was August 16th, is the one that kind of gave the information as to the way the situation is right now. But from what I could tell, even though Attica was 45 years ago, back in 1971, things still have not changed. The prisons are overcrowded. One of the prisons that I read about in Texas has a 200% overage, and several of the prisons had 200% overages. Now, one thing I did understand about the private prisons is that there has been light shedded on them lately, and one of the governmental agencies that covered the prisons, I believe it's Homeland Security, is now recommending that we reduce the number of private prisons. So even though the prisoners have been fighting this largely on their own, they are making some headway, because I did read today that that is going to happen. And I wondered what we could say that would help people out in the audience know what to do to help the situation, because many times you cannot enter the prisons and you don't have any rights, and neither does the prisoner. So our hands are kind of tied. And the other thing about private prisons is they don't have to divulge some of the information that the federal prisons divulge. I was able to find financials on Corrections Corporation of America, and I believe that in 2015 they generated about $498 million. And when I looked them up on the stock market, their stock, if you look them up today, is CXW. If you want to check out my sources, CXW, they are trading on the stock market at $24 per share, and they're valued at $2.9 billion. So when people say they're not making profit, from what I could tell, as I researched, it seems like they are making profit. I think we have another clip, Molly, that might shed some more light onto this situation.
You know, private corporations are making money, but the state is losing money because they were using that prison labor themselves. And we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
I'm Eddie Conway, coming to you from Baltimore. And thank you for joining me for a special episode of Rattling the Bars. in the United States of America the day there is a massive national prison strike by prisoners all across the country. And joining me to kind of like give us some information about it is Reverend Kenneth Glasgow. Reverend Glasgow, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, I talked to you several months ago, and when the Alabama prison was on strike, and I know they had called for this national strike. Now it seems to be happening. Can you bring us up to date? What's going on? How long it's been going on, and how widespread is it?
Well, so what we have on the second week of the national prison strike, and it's a work stoppage. It was originally called and initiated and organized, and we have to give a hand to those guys in FAM, the Free Alabama Movement in Holman Prison. That's Robert Earl Council, Melvin Ray, and James Pleasant, who are the three guys that originated Free Alabama Movement, who initiated, called for the strike, and organized the strike. We have to give them a hand because they have went beyond religious barriers, beyond racial barriers, beyond geographical barriers, and definitely beyond incarcerated barriers, and had got up to 24 states to agree to be involved and engage and participate in the prison strike in 40 to 50 different prisons. As of today, as a matter of fact, when y'all told me you wanted to do the interview, we checked and we got alerts and we got out there and got confirmation of 11 states that are still on the work stoppage strike, and 11 different states. And the reason they're doing it is because the free prison labor trade, free slavery trade inside prison has been overlooked for so long. We got plenty of people out here that are making, for instance, in Holman, they have to make about 20,000 license plates a day to meet their 100,000 a week quota, which makes about $1.7 billion, not million, billion dollars a year. But they're paying their inmates inside who's making this quota. Some of them are getting less than a dollar. Some of them are getting 15 cents, and some of them are getting nothing at all. Everything that goes on inside the prison system, the laundry, the cooking, the construction, you may have an electrician that's there that has the skills and the license, but all of the labor that's being done is being done by those who are incarcerated. So what we have is free prison labor going on that is not only for those that's in the prison, but also for these private industries and companies that are using free prison labor. If you don't mind, we'll name some. And
yeah,
I know
name,
the women
name
gonna
a
have
couple,
a fit.
Please.
The women gonna have a fit, but Victoria's Secret. I love McDonald's, but McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Walmart. The Walmart has in their agreement that they don't use free prison labor, but they all the products that they have are from free prison labor. So these are the things that's happening. And you know, you got people out there that's gonna say, well, these guys are in prison. They don't have rights. They're serving their time. But guess what? A taxpayer out there should have be the first one that's jumping up and down. Because taxpayers are paying anywhere from $31,000 to $80,000 a year to keep somebody incarcerated, depending on what state you're in. And these taxpayers are paying for them to be in there, but they're being warehoused. There's no rehabilitation. There's no education. There's no skills being taught. So they're just being warehoused and used for free prison labor. And then the taxpayers should be mad again because those who done served in the military, those who done served their country, cannot get jobs out here because guess what? They're using free prison labor. Now, where the media and where the government and the private industries and all have been bamboozling the people is by saying that, hey, they've been outsourcing. The reason we don't have jobs, the reason the unemployment rate is so high is because the private industries and companies have been outsourcing to different countries and their products is outsourcing. Well, they haven't been outsourcing. They've been insourcing using free prison labor.
Well, that gave you an idea. Also, I'd like to put in here that the prison commissaries in private prisons are run like a company store. families are not allowed to send care packages like they used to, only money. The store overprices toothpaste, soap, and everything that you need, and the low wages these people earn just doesn't cover it.
That reminds me of the phone calls. For them to make a phone call is anywhere from a dollar up to $14 a minute, up to $14 a minute for them to make a phone call. And the telephone company that is in the prisons, I think it's GTL, they earn millions of dollars a year on the prisoners and their phone calls home. And if the prisoners are not able to make phone calls home, then that probably plays into the recidivism that we see, because when they come out, those relationships are, you know, probably broken. Well, who's supervising all of these prisons?
Unicor
is supervising all the prisons, and that is it's wholly owned, self-sustaining government. It's a wholly owned, self-sustaining government corporation that sells market price services and quality goods made by inmates. Now, many of us have seen on TV and heard in the songs how they make the license plates and all of that. But, oh, my goodness, Molly, there's so many more things they do. Tell us about California right quick.
Okay. California doesn't have private prisons, but the state used them because they had a long drought and they had fires, real serious forest fires. And so the California Attorney General Office concluded that as firefighters for the state, these prisoners save the state over $1 billion a year. I guess that was 2 years in a row. Many prisoners were supposed to be released from prison before they got out to fight fires, but they were delayed because the prison firefighters were a commodity too valued to lose. And over 4,400 prisoners were at 42 camps, including 3 for women. Even though the prisoners worked outside the prison and were clearly not a threat to society, they were kept until the state no longer needed that cheap labor. If they had gone on strike, they might have been hired at prevailing wage. That would have been a good deal.
Well, you know, you might be thinking, well, what do I care? These are prisoners. They've committed a crime. I read an article. One of the articles said that over 100,000 of those that are in the jails and in long-term incarceration are not guilty of the crimes. They have not been to trial yet. But what I did find is that 353 products are being made by Unicor. This is being made by the prisoners. And these products and services are for banks, energy producers, utility companies, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, manufacturing companies, telemarketing companies, including the telephones that they use to call home, transportation companies and other companies like maybe I better not name the companies, but organization associations, but there's lots of them. So, wow, hopefully you get the message. Look up some of these companies. I know Corrections Corporation of America is changing their names to Civic Corps, but nothing's changed. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and we hope you found the show informative. We want you to stay right here because coming up next will be an interview with labor historian Priscilla Morolo about the U.S. and how past fights might help us today. This is Barbara Wright.
And Molly Madden.
So stay tuned for the next segment of Heartland Labor Forum.
This holiday, why not give a gift of cultural education to our youth in Kansas City? Come to an educational fundraiser called Tis the Season, sponsored by the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center and Museum on Saturday, December the 17th at 6 o'clock p.m. Our website is brucewatkinscenter.com or call 816-513-0700. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI congratulates the Heartland Labor Forum for once again winning first prize for radio shows in the International Labor Communications 2016 Labor Media Awards. Tino Scalisi's Joe Hill's Last Will won first prize for long-form audio, and Tino and Chris Mann won honorable mention best long-form audio for a new crop of women leaders report back from the Midwest for Women Workers and UAW Auto Negotiation No More Tears. Congratulations to Chris, Tino, Judy Ansel, and the whole Heartland Labor Forum team.
Put it there, boy, and we'll Show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do. Well, I'm gonna tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
And that was Mr. Woody Guthrie singing his popular union hit, All You Fascists Bound to Lose. And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. Tonight's show, Fascism and Labor, a historical look back. In this next segment, we're going to focus on how American labor identified and fought fascism and the lessons that workers and their unions can learn in 2016 to fight this reemergence of these dangers before they take firmer root. Or could it be too late to save ourselves? Let's look at a phrase from history. Fordism is fascism. That's my employer. That's why I pick on them. It was a rallying cry for the newly founded United Auto Workers Union. And the equation was partly political, but at the same time, it was a democratic response to the dictator philosophy of Henry Ford and his service department, and that grew to such prevalence that elements of that philosophy still serve as the foundation for industrial relations today. It's the boss's way or no way. It's at-will employment. If you don't like it, quit. And there's 1,000 more to take your place. Have you heard this before? Two diametrically opposed ways of carrying on industry came to the fore. There was one, Fordism, which attempted to remove all trace of humanity from the production process, and the other that asserts that the rights and the dignities of free men and women living in a democratic country include, in part, the right to unionize and to set standards and to remove wages and working conditions from competition. And even more, that workers will have a direct say in how the union is run. Aggressive pro-business interests, the likes of which have not been seen since the Roaring Twenties, are now at the gate, and they don't have to break in anymore. They have a key. What might we as working people expect? Just in terms of labor policy, President-elect Trump has nominated Andrew Puzder, chief executive of CKE Restaurants, to lead the United States Department of Labor. Puzder was quoted in March 2016 as saying that automation would be a welcome development because machines were, quote, always polite, they always upsell, they never take a vacation, they never show up late, there's never a slip and fall, or an age, sex, or race discrimination case. Is that how we're going to make America great again? Joining us on the phone from Sarah Lawrence College in New York is historian and author Dr. Priscilla Murillo. Priscilla co-authored From the Folks Who Brought You the Weekend, A Short Illustrated History of Labor in the United States, and The Common Ground of Womanhood, Class, Gender, and Working Girls Clubs. She's a contributor to various anthologies and educational projects sponsored by labor and community organizations, is a reviewer for the Journal of American History, the Journal of Urban History, International Labor and Working Class History, and others. Priscilla, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be there.
Thank you so much. So we're covering a lot of ground, and I know that we don't have a whole lot of time tonight, but for our listeners, there's a lot being bandied about this concept of fascism. First, what is fascism, and why is it such a threat to American society?
Well, I think that the most accurate definition of fascism is it's the heaviest-handed rule of big business in collaboration with government. And big business and big government come together, and as they are now, actually, when big business and big government come together and really impose a fist on the rest of society, say, we're in charge, we're taking over now, that's fascism. And usually there are people involved in that kind of situation who feel like they're saving the nation, but they are saving the nation in ways that, as you put it, it's my way or the highway. So I think that it's not an exaggeration to say that Henry Ford was a real fan of fascism. He was certainly a fan of Germany's Nazis, and the Nazis admired him just as much as he admired them. You know, there was a life-size portrait of Henry Ford in Adolf Hitler's office. And in 1938, did you know that?
No.
Yeah. And in 1938, Ford received the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, and that was the highest honor that the Nazi regime could give a non-German. And Hitler said about Henry Ford, I shall do my best to put his theories into practice in Germany. Now, one of Ford's theories was anti-Semitism. He despised Jews, but Hitler was an anti-Semite long before he came across Henry Ford. When Hitler spoke of what was Fordism, what he had in mind was the exceptionally heavy-handed control of the workplace and workers.
I see.
And now, and one essential tool for asserting control that Ford's executives actually developed and the Ford Motor Company pioneered was the moving assembly line, the moving conveyor belt, because that means that the speed of the line determines the pace of work.
Mm-hmm.
And Ford adopted that early in 1913, but pretty soon all of the auto companies were using it, and its installation always translated into a speed-up. Now, about the same time, Ford implemented a plan that attempted to exert control over workers' lives outside the plant. And this plan was the $5 day. The year after they introduced the assembly line, Ford established a system in which workers could get as much as $5 a day, which was about twice as much as the average automobile worker made at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And if you translate that into today's dollars, it comes to about $37,000 a year. So no one was becoming very wealthy with a $5 a day, but they were certainly doing a lot better than the average. But there were catches to the deal. The $5 a day, first of all, it was for men only. Women who worked in the plant, there were about 10% of the employees were women. They could not get the $5 a day. Mm-hmm. And they had to be men who measured up to Henry Ford's standards. So, for example, if your foreman said, this guy works slow, he seems to like labor unions, this was a strictly non-union plant at that point, he seems to like labor unions, he has a big mouth, you were not going to get the $5 a day. But it wasn't just what went on in the plant. If you drank, if you gambled, if your wife had a job, if you didn't have a savings account, if your home wasn't neat and clean, you were not eligible for the $5 a day. And the way that Ford figured out all of that was they had what they called the sociological department that employed up to 200 investigators that would fan out and visit workers' homes, talk to their neighbors, inspect their bank books, and so on. So when you come right down to it, the $5 a day was really about control, not fair pay. And besides, right after World War One, when the economy went into recession, they threw out the $5 a day. Henry Ford always thought that there were recession times were good because you could discipline workers just by their fear of unemployment. And at that point, right after World War One, the sociology department merged into the company's service department that you mentioned earlier. And the service department had a different way of exerting control, and that was violence, organized violence. Basically, it was a private police force. You could even call it a private army inside the Ford structure. Its head was this guy, Harry Bennett. He was former Navy boxer and a thug. And he put together a very large squad of thugs whose job was to keep unions out of Ford. In 1932, when unemployed workers in the Detroit area held a hunger march in front of the Ford plant in Dearborn, Michigan, the service department got together with local police. They attacked the crowd. They fired into the crowd. They clubbed them, they beat them, and about 60 demonstrators were injured, and 4 demonstrators were killed. Later in the 1930s, when the United Auto Workers, really in its infancy then, was organizing the rest of the industry, Ford held out. And the service department did the dirty work to make that holdout possible. You know, their most infamous act took place in May 26, 1937, at what the UAW called the Battle of the Overpass. And that afternoon, May 26, union organizers showed up to leaflet the Dearborn plant, and operatives from the service department beat them to a pulp, threw one of them off a bridge, broke someone's back, and then turned on the news reporters and photographers who were recording the scene. But the news got out nonetheless, and so did some photographs, because one of the photographers was able to trick them. They confiscated what they thought were the plates for his pictures, but he had hidden the real plates and gave them blank plates.
Mm-hmm.
So the news did get out, and which is why we know about this attack. There are many other attacks that went unrecorded.
One thing that I wanted to ask you was, you know, if someone were to look at the industrial policy of Henry Ford at the time and say, look, this just makes good sense. Why don't we have an assembly line? It would be more efficient. And, you know, men ought not to be drinking while they're, you know, doing whatever. And they ought to live in this pure sort of a way, or this healthy and moral and upstanding lifestyle. And besides, if I'm the employer, then and I'm giving you a good wage, then it stands to reason that, you know, you're going to meet some of these conditions as a condition of employment. Why was there such backlash? And was it not until Ford reacted violently, or was there pushback before? And what was labor's response?
Well, there was pushback before.
Okay.
In fact, in 1914, the Industrial Workers of the World tried to organize at Ford, but failed. So there was pushback earlier, and I think for many people, sometimes the sociological department would report, oh, this guy just won't even answer our questions. You know, this guy insulted us. We're not going to give him the $5 day because he insulted us. And this wasn't about drinking on the job.
Sure.
This was about, did you drink at home, or did your neighbors complain that maybe you're too loud? You know, maybe you and your wife fought loudly.
Interesting.
And so it's really an attempt to control the whole life of the worker. And if they would ask you, do you have savings? And it wasn't good enough to say, oh, yeah, I've saved this. We'll bring the bank book in. We're going to look at it. You had to show them proof that you were saving your money. So, or if your kids got in trouble at school, then you might lose the $5 day because somebody had said that Junior was a juvenile delinquent.
Sure.
So it's really a way to try to control the whole of workers' lives, all of it. And I think that people reacted badly. Everybody liked it to get the $5 day.
Sure.
But people reacted badly to the idea that they're going to be policed by their boss. One thing to have the foreman breathing on your neck at work, that's bad enough. But to have an investigator from the company coming to your house to nose around and ask what's going on in your house, that was too much for a lot of people.
Now, was there a fear at the time that microcosm, that small Ford community, that would become sort of a model for some national movement? Was there ever any concern about that, that the ideas espoused by Henry Ford and this dictatorial control over every aspect of your life, not just your work life, would bloom into some sort of national movement as it had in other parts of the world?
Well, I think that people were mostly concerned about the violence, because the by the 1930s, when fascism's really on the march in Europe, you know, it comes to power in Italy early in the 1920s, but not until the 1930s in Germany, when the fascist movements were really on the rise in Europe, the Ford company had moved away from what you could call the velvet glove over the iron fist, and was just using the iron fist.
Okay.
So that was straight up violence, and Ford wasn't alone in that. You know, just a few days, 4 days after that Battle of the Overpass, came the Memorial Day massacre in Chicago. You know, workers at Republic Steel in South Chicago were on strike. On Memorial Day, they held a march with friends and family in front of the plant. And the police who were stationed there fired into the crowd. 50 people were shot. 10 were shot fatally. And about 100 were clubbed.
And this is over a labor strike?
Treated.
And this is over a labor
strike? Strike.
Huh.
And you know, a newsreel team was there. Paramount Newsreel, they used to show these newsreels in the movie theaters. And the Paramount studios had a newsreel team that would go around and report on things. And so they had a newsreel team there to film the event. But at a crucial moment, they either turned off that camera or the excuse was they said, oh, we were changing the lens. So there's a gap in the film right before the police start firing into the crowd. And so there was no photographic evidence to contradict the police contention that they were merely acting in self-defense. Mm-hmm. And none of the officers involved in that massacre was indicted or disciplined for it. And Paramount News, which had the film, you can look at it now on YouTube because it's been recovered, but Paramount Newsreel decided not to show it in movie theaters. So they were afraid it was going to incite people too much.
Sure.
It really is brutal. You see, like, hundreds of police turning on people and, you know, shooting and clubbing.
You mentioned, Priscilla, you mentioned that during this international rise in the fascist movement in Europe and elsewhere, that employers and political movements, but the employers in particular in the United States took off the velvet gloves to reveal the iron fist. Why do you think that they felt so emboldened by that time? Why would they not continue? Because they were having a fair amount of success with, if you could say that it was a softer approach, I'm not sure that it was. Why would they go just full out?
Well, you know, during the first few years of the Depression, the big employers that had these sort of welfare programs, company welfare programs, tried to keep them intact. But they couldn't afford to keep them intact. Mm-hmm. So what they did, initially they tried not to lay off, especially they didn't want to lay off skilled workers because mm-hmm. they kept thinking, well, if when the economy gets better, if we have lost our skilled workers, right? Then we're in trouble. So what they do is said they'd take a pattern maker and they said, well, we don't need you in the pattern maker, the tool maker, right? They'd say, we don't need you doing tool making, but we're going to put you on the press. Mm-hmm. And at least we'll keep you employed. Well, those workers they did not like that, right? And a lot of the people who became the most militant in industry, the most militant supporters of unionization, were those people who had been moved from a more skilled job to a less skilled job. They weren't accustomed to being pushed around in that way. That's one thing. And the other thing is that the employers just didn't have the money to carry that on.
Okay.
And the third thing is, when they're looking at, you know, remember, in the 1920s, it did not look like mass industrial unionism was going anywhere. You would not have bet that auto and steel and rubber and glass were all going to be unionized in the 1930s. Nobody would have made that bet because, in fact, industrial unionism receded in the early 1920s.
Priscilla,
so places. Yeah.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry to have to cut you off. Maybe we can do a part two of fascism and labor with Priscilla Morell. I appreciate you so much for coming on and joining us today. Hopefully we can learn from these lessons from history and apply them in 2016 because it looks like we've got one heck of a struggle coming up. Thank you so much for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Oh, you are welcome. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
In July 1913, over 7,000 miners struck the C&H Copper Mining Company in Calumet, Michigan. It was largely the usual issues of people who worked for a big company during a time when capitalists ran roughshod over their workers, a time when monopolies were a way of life. Stryker's demands included pay raises, an end to child labor, and safer conditions, including an end to one-man drill operations, as well as support beams in the mines, which mine owners didn't want because support beams were costly, but miners killed in cave-ins, quote, do not cost us anything. 6 months without work left many miners' families with little food for the holidays and no money for presents, so the Ladies Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners held a Christmas party for the kids. 500 children and 200 adults showed up that day, Christmas Eve 1913. It was held on the second floor of Calumet's Italian Hall. The only way in and out was a very steep stairwell. As darkness fell and people began to go home to their own family celebrations, some of the children gathered around the stage as presents were passed out. For many, it would be the only gift they'd received this year. In the middle of this festive celebration, someone, possibly more than one person, opened the door at the bottom of the staircase and yelled, "Fire!" Chaos ensued. As everyone headed down the stairs to the exit, the door was blocked from the outside, and children and adults were trampled, then suffocated, by the throng of bodies trying to escape the fire, which didn't actually exist. In all, 73 people, including 59 children, died, most of them Finnish immigrants. The youngest was Raphael Caesar, 2.5 years old. The oldest was Kate Pateri, 66 years old. Some families lost all of their children, like Frank and Giuseppa Cleric, who buried their three daughters, Christina, 11, Maria, 9, and Katerina, 7. Their little crosses are still lined in a row over their graves in a cemetery west of Calumet. The culprits who yelled into the hall that day to start the tragedy were never identified, but it's widely suspected that it was allies of mine management or the owners who did so to disrupt the miners' party. No one was ever prosecuted or even arrested for causing the massacre. It is always thus. Those with money and power control the narrative, silence the truth, and thwart justice. Italian Hall was demolished in the 1980s, but especially during the holiday season, the people of Calumet still talk of that night, 100 years ago, when so many innocents perished. Partly because a lot of miners left Calumet behind after this tragedy, the strike didn't accomplish what the miners wanted. However, it's considered a turning point for union strength in Michigan's copper country. In 1941, Woody Guthrie got an idea for a song about the tragedy, which he called the 1913 Massacre. Ella Reeve, mother, Bloor's eyewitness account in her 1940 book, We Are Many, inspired him. Mother Bloor was a labor organizer who was active in the Western Federation of Miners, the union that represented the people who were on strike in Calumet. Take a trip with me in 1913 to Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I will take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners are having their big Christmas ball. I will take you in a door and up a high stairs. Singing and dancing is heard everywhere. I will let you shake hands with the people you see and watch the kids dance around the Christmas tree. You ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you they make less than $1 a day. Working the copper claims risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with children and wives. There's talking and laughing and songs in the air. And the spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all. And you're dancing around and around in the hall. Well, a little girl sits down by the Christmas tree lights to play the piano, so you have to keep quiet. To hear all this fun, you would not realize that the copper boss's thug men are milling outside. The copper boss's thugs stuck their heads in the door. One of them yelled and he screamed, "There's a fire!" A lady, she hollered, "There's no such a thing! Keep on with your party, there's no such a thing!" A few people rushed and it was only a few. It's just the thugs and the scabs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and carried her down. But the thugs held the door and he could not get out. And then others followed, 100 or more. But most everybody remained on the floor. The gun thugs, they laughed at their murderous joke, while the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. Such a terrible sight I never did see. We carried our children back up to their tree. The scabs outside still laughed at their spree. And the children that died there were 73. The piano played a slow funeral tune, and the town was lit up by a cold Christmas moon. The parents, they cried, and the miners, they moaned. See what your greed for money has done. That song was by Woody Guthrie, and this article was from Upworthy.com. I'm Ariana Eckel.
Hi, we have a very short calendar because labor activities and all sorts of other activities don't happen around Christmas time for obvious reasons. Everybody's really busy getting ready for the holidays. So I'm going to announce the Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, which is going to be Tuesday, January 3rd, kicking off the new year. And all are welcome who believe in economic justice. This is at 6:30 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut in KCMO. And as we get events for January, we'll be letting you know about them. You can check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can listen to past shows and archived shows and see our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be called Serving Up Justice on Campus. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.